Okay, so this is the beginning of the Connecting the Dots 1 hour Sunday evening program that Kelly Kerner and I, Charlie Swenson, do on average about once a month. And so hi, Kelly.
Hey there. Hey, Charlie.
There.
Hey, everybody.
And what's really funny about this call is that because Perry Hoffman's actually driving in the car back from a conference in Boston that I was at, I'm actually managing the ship, meaning muting people.
We all may be muted.
God knows what's going to happen here. You could be muted at any point, so you should say whatever you want to say to your significant others right now, because you never know when I'm going to... I don't know. You know, I don't know how to control this system, but it looks like I've got it under control now. So anyway, here's what here's the agenda for tonight. As we get started, though, as those of you who've listened know that the agenda kind of unfolds as we go, but here's the intended agenda, is a kind of a report back from a conference this weekend, the North American Society for the Study of Personality Disorders, NASSPD. Make a note of that. It was the first annual conference. It's essentially a new organization growing out of embers of an old organization, which was ARPD once, the Association for Research in Personality Disorders. And it's connected to the International Society for Study of Personality Disorders. And it was just a great start. And so it was the first annual conference, and that means there's going to be other annual conferences, and it really is about personality disorders, all personality disorders. So I went to it. Perry Hoffman was the co-director of the conference, along with Mary Zanarini, who's at McLean Hospital, has done a ton of research about borderline personality disorder measures and rating and longitudinal course and stuff that many people on this phone call probably know. And so NEABPD was the co-sponsor of this and played a very prominent role in it. I want to first say, just sort of on a human note, Kelly, about this. I get a little emotional just thinking about it, but everybody knows what happened last week in Boston, and it was very upsetting. I live in Massachusetts. I used to live in the Boston area. I ran in the Boston Marathon, and everybody in the world probably who heard all the stories was upset about it. And so this conference was to start Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, and Friday was the day of this sort of the manhunt of these two guys. I mean, after killing one of them, the manhunt of the other one. And it went on into the evening Friday night, and there was all this debate about should there be the conference or not. Millions of emails and phone calls, and are we having it? Because people were coming in from overseas and all over the United States and Canada. So it was very touch and go. Mary Zanarini made the call to go ahead and have it. I think she was just hoping that things would get resolved by Saturday morning, and then lo and behold, you know, to a significant degree they did. I drove in at 5 in the morning from where I live be there in time, because I was the lead-off hitter in this conference. I was like at 8 o'clock in the morning I was interviewing somebody in front of everybody. So the conference went on. Most presenters were there, the vast majority. A lot of participants were there. There were cancellations. And it was just really cool, real interesting. So anyway.
Thanks for saying that, Charlie. I think a lot of people have been touched by it. It's important. I think the other, you know, the strength of choosing to continue, I've been following a lot of the positive stories of heroism and kindness and you know, that sort of spirit of coming together. So I really appreciate you pausing.
Oh, I tell you, I got on the Mass Turnpike at 5 in the morning to go to Boston, and immediately there were signs, big signs, you know, electronic signs all through Massachusetts saying we are one Boston. We are one Boston. And then it thanks people. And it was every time I saw the sign, you'd think, oh, God, that sounds kind of trite and overstated. But somehow being here, it felt exactly right. It just was comforting. And it was inspiring how people handled a lot of this. And that the conference went on, and there was a real feeling of, oh, my God, thank God we can have this conference. And once it got started, it was very engaging. And people were really into it. And last night there was a banquet among lots of people went to it. And it was really inspiring, fun. There were some awards given out as the first annual conference. And so anyway, it was very – this was the backdrop of the whole conference. It wasn't the content of the conference. But there was a tone of the conference that I think in a strange way was supported by this. Felt like, well, okay, we're all here. So that was cool. So, Kelly, what I want to tell you about, and we kind of agreed that I would talk some about these things and then that you might have questions or you might just follow up on things I say. You might, you know, be like the interviewer. You can be the, whatever, John Stewart or whoever you
Dick
want to be.
Cavett. No, Dick Cavett. He's the best
ever. Oh, my
ever.
God. Dick Cavett. Is he dead now? I mean, that's funny. Yeah, he was a great interviewer.
Yeah, he's a little bit before my time, but I've watched many of his interviews.
You could be
anyway,
Piers Morgan
going.
If you like him. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm a little giddy. So anyway, the conference had many different kinds of presentations, and I've just decided to sort of pick and choose things that I thought would be of interest to me, to you, to this people listening to this phone call, and say a few things about them. At first, just two or three presentations that I just want to introduce people to, and then I want to talk more about the part I played, which was to be one of four people interviewing an actress who was playing a person with borderline personality disorder. We were each demonstrating a different model of treatment. So I want to talk some about that. But let me start with and let me say to everybody on the line that one of the fabulous things about NEABPD is every time they do a conference, and since they co-sponsored this, it's true also with this, is you're going to be able, once it's on the website, and I don't know when that'll be, but sometime soon, you'll be able to go to the website of NEABPD and see the PowerPoints of all the presentations, the videos. They tape the whole thing. So it's just fabulous. So that allows me to make mistakes in telling you things, and then they can be corrected. So I'll just assume myself correctable because these are scribbled notes that I'm talking from. So the first one, Jill Hooley, who many people on the phone know, has done a lot of research on families, including families of borderline personality disorder, has done research with Perry Hoffman on expressed emotion in families of borderline personality disorder. She presented a really interesting study. She was talking about how that we all know from fair amount of research now, and some more was presented during this conference, that there is in people with a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, there's a sort of a hyperreactivity to negative emotional stimuli, and that you can see that in brain scanning, functional MRI brain scanning in parts of the brain that are hyperreactive, like the amygdala is hyperreactive if you're being exposed to negative emotional stimuli even in controlled conditions. So what Jill started asking was, how do people with borderline personality disorder process positive stimuli? And not only subjectively and measurably that way, but also in the brain with functional MRIs and scanning. So, and in particular, praise. So the way she studied this is that she had female patients with diagnosis of borderline from ages 19 to 35. And she had a total, actually, of 13 with borderline personality disorder, 10 with dysthymia, but not with borderline disorder, so people with chronic negative emotional state. And then healthy controls, people that don't have a mood disorder or borderline disorder, 11 of them. And then the praise stimulus was interesting. She would have people in a scanner, so it's all being tracked biologically as well as emotionally by the individuals, and they are listening while they're in a scanner to a female voice that's commenting on them. As if they're commenting on them, it's sort of as if you're hearing somebody tell somebody else nice things about you. Mm-hmm. You get it, Kelly?
Yeah, interesting. Is it standardized, or is it actually a real thing about, you know, like I have blue eyes, not brown, so if somebody's commenting on my eyes, it would be specific?
I think they were standardized. There were
okay.
And there would be, and a person would listen like to four comments with 20 seconds each, and then okay. There'd be a rest between, and then they would hear another comment and rest between. So you could both measure them right when they were hearing this positive comment. And there were, 20 or 40. This is where you'll get it if you get it on the PowerPoints. But the 20 or 40 samples that they would mm-hmm. then use. And I don't think it was tailored and individualized, but I could be wrong
okay.
about that. But
okay.
it wasn't my impression. And so you could also see not only what was the initial response in the brain, but also how did that response unfold given a little bit of time. And so first of all, she wanted to find out, do people with borderline personality disorder actually rate these statements? I wish I could read one to you, but I don't have it in front of me. Those of you who look it up on the website, you're going to see a sample because it was on a PowerPoint slide, a sample of one of these things. It was several sentences long, and it said things like, you know, I just love her. She's such a positive. She's such a positive force. She's got a great sense of humor, a really quirky sense of humor, and she's you know, just nice to be around, and things like that, that you would just die and go to heaven if you heard people saying about you when they thought you weren't hearing it. And so you would hear one of these, and then you would have people rate, was this a positive statement? And it turns out people with borderline personality disorder were absolutely the same as the other two groups in rating the comments as very positive, pretty uniformly. So there was no difference in rating those comments as positive. Second, she asked, how were they affected? So what kind of mood state did it create subjectively right while hearing the comments right afterwards? And once again, the findings were that it was really just the same as the two control groups, the dysthymia as well as so-called healthy controls, which was that it did create right away an increase. It increased a positive mood state and it decreased negative mood states to hear this. So that was interesting. And then the third thing she was looking at was brain activation. There was significant differences that separated the people with borderline disorder from the other two groups. Kelly, what would you guess?
Tell me.
No, you. What would you guess?
Like a
Come
general.
On. Come
well,
on.
I'm wondering,
what do you think?
Like that there might have been some sort of heightened, it either was like negative reinforcement, so the bad thing you thought was going to happen didn't happen, or it actually exacerbated, made you more vigilant for threats. You know, like, okay, they said it, and now the expectations, and now I'm just going to be, something bad, the other shoe's going to drop.
Your prediction of in the brain, The things that you might see change in the brain, you think might mirror that sort of pattern of maybe an initial. Yeah, so let me tell you rather than hold you on the hook like this. I just thought it'd be fun. So she looked at different aspects of the brain, in particular the things you'd think might change. Like there's the reward system in the brain, which is primarily located in the putamen and the caudate of the brain and with dopamine receptors, right? Then there's another, center, so to speak, or network of attention and cognition, which is centered in the anterior cingulate cortex of the brain. And then there's the interoceptive processing, which is the processing of how does it feel inside you, which is more found in what's called the insula in the brain. So she tracked the activation of those three areas. And what was significantly different is this. The caudate, the reward processing in the caudate, when the praise began, the people with borderline disorder did show activation not as much as the healthy controls. And interestingly, the dysthymia patients showed the most activation when praise began of the reward system. So that was just people, you know, with borderline did show that at the beginning. And then the putamen, which is the other part of the reward processing, this was where it got different, is that it did get activated in borderline personality disorder right at first, but rather quickly it actually shut it down. And the others continued to be activated. So people with borderline, after a few seconds, there was always already this huge change. It's basically almost turned off the activation of the putamen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the reward system began and it said just quickly stopped, which could be consistent with one of your sort of guesses there, your interpretations.
Yeah.
Now
like
the insula, which is the one
validation. Let me. I just make sure I'm getting it? It's almost like praise is a cue that invalidation is going to come. You know, is next. The other shoe will drop.
Well, that's an interpretation. I mean, that could be.
Yeah. That's interesting.
You're saying that the person it's a cue that may in the moment be experienced like, you know, another brain, but that it quickly, may set off. Yeah, and it may be a trigger for memories of invalidation, expectation of invalidation, and sort of deep brain processing that has to do with just
like
going in that direction.
Yeah,
just robs you.
Okay, but
doesn't
yeah.
It's so interesting. And then the insula, which is the one that processes sort of your feeling state. People with borderline personality disorder group significantly activated the least. So it was kind of like a disconnect or kind of not that sort of interior sense of having a positive affect. And just the final one, the cingulate, which has to do with attention and cognition, the people with borderline personality disorder just didn't activate, whereas the dysthymic patients and the controls did activate. It's sort of like, what happened? So the part about the activation of heightened attention and heightened sort of alertness with cognition didn't happen. So it was just so interesting. Now, I'll just say something about the notes. The implications that Jill talked about is that basically she said in the brain, people with borderline personality disorder, at least by this study, looks like praise gets very little traction, is the way she's putting it.
Mm-hmm.
They're not feeling it. They're not attentive to it. And while there is this brief initial response, there's just much less of a reward response. So it really is not something that really works that way. And that it's possible that she was saying that in the social world, people with borderline personality disorder just maybe aren't experiencing that part of the social world, the positive cues, the positive triggers that give you a sustained positive response that you can kind of like count on and that serve as reward, serve as reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, interestingly, people with chronic low-level depression actually got a lot out of praise, including in their brain structures. So now I just thought this was just research to build on. It's incredibly interesting. I brought up with her, I made a comment at this point when she was asking for questions that I once had a patient that I did this for a different reason. I did an exposure exercise in every session for a couple of months with this particular patient because we had figured out when we were figuring out all the things that triggered shame in her, which was at the stage 2 of DBT, and we were working on exposure to shame. And one of the things that made her feel most ashamed was to hear positive statements about herself. And what even made her feel more ashamed was to make positive statements about herself. So every session for about 2 months, we would just take one part of the session, and I would just say, okay, we picked various positive statements. We picked the ones that would trigger the most shame and have her just say them and say them with increasing amounts of feeling and pseudo-conviction until there was a sense of conviction. And because at first it just was horrible for her to say it, but by the end, after a couple months, she was actually quite able to say, you know, I think I'm a person worth caring about. And she could hold that. And so what I said to Jill was, I wondered if people who have borderline personality disorder might, it might trigger shame. That might be part of the problem. It might trigger that invalidation sense that you're talking about. This may be, maybe this is a kind of a brain pattern recognition of a sense of invalidation or shame. And,
or like escape, just the immediate, in the same way you might get a freeze response, that there's some, that you process it, and then there's some either shame fires. I think that that's very reasonable, what you're saying, and or you may not, it may be so quick you don't really even have that sense, you've just escaped.
So now it might be that, when you don't have borderline disorder and you hear praise, that maybe you can say the, maybe immediately you start kind of, I don't know, almost like without being aware of it, repeat it to yourself for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You might have the capacity to say, oh, yeah, I am a good person. Oh, I do have a good sense. Oh, I do have a good sense of humor. Oh, I'm so quirky. Isn't this great? I'm being a little over the top, but, I mean, there is this capacity maybe to be triggered into that and then to have the experience of sustaining it that requires hearing your own voice, so to speak, or anticipating that you can tolerate this.
Interesting.
You know, so I thought that was a great study.
Yeah, it's really interesting, Charlie. It makes me also think about some of the deficits about self-referential memory. And I'm just going to put that to the side for a second because I don't want to pull us off track. But I think that the your idea that there's a way where maybe when a certain type of cue comes, the way you begin to then elaborate or it connects to other things. And the way that you're saying may not be as strong with some of the folks who have more self-referential memory problems, the inability to bring back real specific episodic memories.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's true. I mean, that is also a research finding. That's been
known
for quite a while.
What else did you hear?
Okay, let me move on to another one because we could say more about that, but I just want to really get through two or three of these things that were just, they just, you know, you go to this kind of conference and in 20 minutes somebody gives a little piece of research and you don't even have time to process it. It's just so cool what she did. So, Kim Gratz, you know Kim, right? Or you know her work?
I've met her a couple times.
Yeah. So Kim, who's now at University of Mississippi and used to be at McLean and has done research for many years, had her more recent research has been on, you know, first developed, I mean, really, really on emotion regulation. And she's the one who, along with somebody else, I think Liz Romer, developed a scale, the DERS scale, the Difficulties in Emotion Regulation scale. And it turns out that a lot of the research that's come out in the last 3-4 years is highly correlating some of the target behaviors that we look at, like deliberate self-harm, being highly correlated with problems with difficulties, specifically in emotion regulation. I mean, if those who know DBT know there's various different sets of skills, but the skills that have to do with emotion regulation being really highly correlated with whether somebody continues to do deliberate self-harm or the frequency and intensity. And so she has looked specifically at it with that, and it's so interesting, the DERS scale, which I've studied a while ago because I was interested in it for purposes in my own treatment system where I work, you know, she did all the research on previous emotion regulation scales, and, you know, the older ideas were that emotion regulation means emotional control, and so there were a lot of good scales on emotional control, but she really broadened it, and she also knew DBT, so she studied those skills. And she put together a scale that really looks at 6 different factors, and one of the factors, though, is really entirely just the experience of emotions, non-avoidance of emotions, with the research that avoidance of emotions is a major coping strategy that's correlated with a lot of problems, including deliberate self-harm. So she put together not only this scale for measuring emotion, difficulties in emotion, but then she's put together a therapy that's called Emotion Regulation Group Therapy that she's written about and published, talked about, and she's done a little bit of training of. And so she did a study with the Emotion Regulation Group Therapy that was really cool. So what is it? Emotion Regulation Group Therapy is like a 14-week group therapy. It's a skills totally a skills training focus for 14 weeks, a couple hours a week. It goes along with any model of individual therapy. They don't dictate anything but just the skills group. And so they hook it on to, as long as there's another practitioner, be it a psychiatrist, a therapist of one persuasion or another, who's seeing the patient, not doesn't even have to be every week, but fairly frequently. So there is a point of reference. There's an individual person. And so they're trying to target emotion dysregulation, and then they're trying to rate over time whether they've changed the DERS scale, the difficulties, whether they've, and it turns out that emotion regulation group training targets exactly the six factors that are measured, of course. And so and some of them are controlling your emotions, and some of them are like distress tolerance skills, like distracting yourself, and some of them are really experiential processing of your emotions, more borrowed from acceptance and commitment therapy than from DBT, even though there's a lot of that in DBT too. But really, Steve Hayes and those people have done so much work on overcoming avoidance and emotional experience and getting into emotional experiencing and mindfulness used in a certain way. So that's really what they teach. So what was interesting then, I'm trying to remember, and I won't remember all of these accurately, so you'll go to the website when it's up, is that they looked at these 14 weeks. They studied people with borderline personality disorder who were in that group therapy, and then people who were in treatment as usual. When they measured the people, and they sort of randomly assigned, and they had a good balance of who the two groups were with the two different conditions, and the people with, in fact, the people that didn't have the group therapy, the control, the treatment as usual, turned out, because they had more individual therapy, to have the exact same amount of time in therapy per person in both arms of the study. So that was pretty neat. And then they did the measures of the DERS at 14 weeks, and then they stopped that treatment, and then they followed for 9 more months. On a regular basis, they would follow, track people down and do the studies of them again. And they were looking at quality of life. They were looking at social connectedness. They were looking at the difficulties of emotion regulation and then deliberate self-harm. And first of all, it was neat that at the end of their 14 weeks, indeed, the people with the emotion regulation group therapy were significantly doing better. They had dropped their self-harm much more than the other group. They had also improved their quality of life situation already. They had solved some problems in their life that put them in a different place in 14 weeks. And they also managed to have better social connectedness and to do, noticeably better on the DERS scale. I should step back and say that this was not your most severe population of borderline personality disorder that they had. I'm forgetting. It was one of the conditions of their study that they actually couldn't take highly suicidal people. But so it was people that met criteria but that didn't meet some of the heavier, more high-frequency, high-intensity criteria. So it's not the same population that some people study with DBT, but kind of a little bit on the higher, a less obvious symptomatology. So the neatest finding is that then as they followed them is that the gains they made extended, all of them, through the next 9 months. I mean, she showed the graphs. Mm-hmm. They just kept getting better. 9 months. Mm-hmm. 9 months. I mean, and kept doing better than the other group for 9 months. And so that was, it was sort of stunning. And I didn't, you didn't get enough time with these people to really get their hypotheses. The one hypothesis I heard her mention about it was that she thought they were thinking it might have to do with that once you've learned these skills and if you have managed to begin to make some changes, problem solving in your life, that actually you're in a different place, and so you then can actually extend the gains because you actually are having a higher quality of life. But who knows? It's just it's a finding to be explained, I think, but a really interesting thing. And I think Kim Gratz's work is really interesting. I mean, every time I go do teaching or training in Sweden on DBT, Kim Gratz has either just been there or she's about to be there. She's always going there because they're really interested in her work and they're implementing her emotion regulation group therapy in some places there.
That's exciting.
So that was cool. That was very cool. So let me just, there are lots of other things. I really encourage people to go to it when it's up. Let me tell you, this was so interesting for me to go there. I mean, I was asked to be part of what they called the Master Clinician Series, and I was the DBT person. And there was a person for mentalization-based therapy. It was one of the developers, Anthony Bateman. And then there was a person for transference-focused therapy that Kernberg originally developed. And one of the leading people in that for many years, Frank Yeomans, was presenting. And then John Gunderson was doing sort of general psychiatric management arm of the treatment, which would correlate with what is sort of seen in the American Psychiatric Association guidelines, and really, it's actually becoming an evidence-based treatment and has good evidence for it. I mean, it was part of what Shelley McMain did in Toronto in her study. So I didn't get to see him, but I did. I was the first one to interview this patient. This young woman was playing a 24-year-old. 24-year-old woman with borderline personality disorder, and who had a lot of relationship problems, would get highly dependent on men and then feel that she couldn't function without them and feel abandoned by them if they didn't respond to her phone calls or texts, and then she would sometimes make suicide attempts in those contexts, and that's what she kind of brought into therapy. And so each person found a way to try to demonstrate their approach by interviewing her. So I'm not sure what to tell you most about this, but, I mean, first, my experience was I was pretty nervous going in. Mm-hmm. How am I going to, can I really reliably demonstrate a good DBT approach that will differentiate it from others here? Because I just, also you've got half an hour to work with, and then you get half an hour to talk. So you combine talking and seeing the patient for half an hour to try to engage the audience in thinking about that treatment model. And I felt pretty good about the DBT one that I did. I chose to see her as if it was our first actual therapy session after getting through intake, and therefore we needed to form an agreement and she needed to commit to not killing herself for the next year of treatment, and then we started to get into not harming herself for the next year of treatment. And I thought I made the point, and I think when I think of the other models, the points that really stand out for me about DBT compared to them, and of course I used to practice the transference focus model, that was my first one that I learned, and is the degree to which DBT, all four models, any model in individual therapy with these patients is facing a lot of data in one session. There's a lot of data. There's a lot of nonverbal data. There's a lot of emotional data. There's a lot of things said. There's a lot going on all the time. Even if there's not much being said, there's a lot going on all the time. And so how do you structure that? How do you take that, and it's kind of like, how do you shape something out of that that lends itself to doing therapeutic work and that also sort of creates coherence? And I think DBT creates coherence by focusing on behavior, that it's really how can we bring down this behavior and bring up this behavior? And that is not what the others are thinking about, the other therapy models. I mean, it really is distinct. And I'll get to each of them. But you're really thinking, how can I decrease How can I decrease suicidal behavior? How can I decrease self-harm? Though actually what I did with her is what I tend to do more and more in my practice, which is of DBT, which is really upfront to have a more, much, and you know this from talking to me, but much more explicit upfront discussion about what would make life worth living and
yeah.
make it really clear, concrete, visual, something you can hang on to, picture, or find out that the person can't do that and then work with that. So, you know, but mm-hmm. then it's kind of how do you get there? And you really, and then the second thing that you're doing other than really just focusing on behaviors going up or down as being the goal of the treatment to get to a life worth living, you're also organizing things on a chain. So the behavioral, nobody else, none of these other models think about a chain. None of them are thinking chronologically, microscopically, horizontally. Here's a chain of events that go on, even though they might actually interview the patient, you know, along a chain of events. They aren't structuring their thinking along a chain. And think in DBT, you really are. You're looking for controlling variables that are usually links on a chain, either antecedents or consequences of the behavior or in the context. So that felt like I demonstrated that.
Cool. Hey, Charlie. So I might change. I think the idea of focusing on the behaviors up or down, I actually think that that's not it's maybe how it gets taught or simplified, but I think like you, I think actually it's just not as well spelled out or it doesn't translate as much, but I think it's more about how can you understand the person's real, like why is suicide an option? Like the reasons for living, you know, questionnaire and all that sort of stuff, but like what is it going to take to really have there be another option for you? And a lot of times it's, so I think of it building, you know, the whole reason to decrease suicide and decrease self-harm is more about those things are solving, they're not great solutions and they generate others. You know, what would it take to work on the primary problems you have, you know, which is driving this kind of distress where you feel so desperate, you gotta solve it in that way. So I think I might phrase it a little bit more, the focus on the emotion dysregulation and the pervasive way that creates. Yeah.
Don't you get there by, it's sort of standard DBT that you start the session by identifying the highest priority target behavior that's been active in the past week. So by definition, you're starting there, but there's from there on, you kind of do anything that works, in a sense, within the model. I mean, and so targeting emotion dysregulation is far and away the most common place you need to end up after.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking more about that initial moves that you're making, or you know, the way in which you're. I think about the changes really being more about building a life that's actually worth living, where suicide isn't the solution, where self-harm isn't the solution, that there's alternatives.
But so Kelly, I think it's
a little different. It's not, emphasis is more on the
emphasis
building.
Might just be different, but nothing you're saying sounds different to me than what I think, but I must be away. I'm thinking that you're doing two things at once if you're thinking in terms of chains, and maybe I loved geometry too much. because I did, and I do, I love math, and so to me, I feel like I'm interacting with a person around a chain of events that lead them into, ruin their lives. And so on the way there, though, why do they end up down there? I mean, is because of the controlling variables. And the controlling variables overwhelmingly often have to do with emotion dysregulation and cognitive dysregulation. So that's where you are, but I'm trying to build another chain. I'm trying to build a chain without suicide in it. I'm trying to build a chain. I mean, I'm not trying to build a chain. That's obviously all a metaphor, but it sort of helps me structure my thinking in the middle of chaos to think that I'm, you know, we're not going down this way. We're going to block this pathway. And when you run into motion dysregulation, either let's help you not run into it so much, let's help you modulate it on the way in, or let's help you have various ways of handling motion dysregulation once it's in place so that you don't end up ruining your life.
Yeah.
And basically, you can always conceptualize that, whether you like to whether it's a helpful way clinically or not might be individual. But I find it helpful, and I think I might end up dealing a lot with the kind of things you're talking about. And I'm certainly not thinking chains every minute, but what
no,
you hear
I'm with
when
you there. I think the piece that I was having a little bit of the weight, at least not the, how I'm thinking about it as much, it's that it's the behaviors up and behaviors down. There's something about that.
Yeah, I know.
There's a way that it can kind of get a little too flat, almost like a caricature. So that's. But anyway, I get your point, and I want to hear.
You know,
about
but I really think part of doing DBT well for me is, and this is in the book that I'm writing on it, sort of. One of the central ideas is that it is always this dialectic between a highly explicit scientific avenue of thought and construction and conceptualization and planning and work, and yet doing it with extraordinarily free, with the freedom to improvise in the moment, and the doing what you need to do, but you know, it's sort of like a researcher that says we're measuring the outcome by this scale, but how you get to the outcome, there might be 4,000 ways. And so I think if you do think behavior up, behavior down, and you think of a chain and you think of all these things, and if that limits your freedom to intervene, I think then DBT can become, I don't want to overstate it because any model can become deadly, but it can become kind of stifling and, like you said, flat. So I think the idea is how do you preserve the scientist in yourself and hang on to, you know, watching outcomes and understanding controlling variables and understanding functional analysis and consequences and all of that, and at the same time, you know, when somebody isn't speaking, coming up with a way to respond that's out of the box, because that flatness that people get doing with DBT is that sometimes it really can stifle the treatment, stifle the patient, and makes patients come to the next therapist like me and say, yeah, Dr. Swenson, I came to see you because you're supposed to be an expert, and the only thing I don't want is DBT.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I've already had that, and not only doesn't it work, I felt like I was in a straitjacket.
Yeah.
You know, I just felt like, God, they won't even let, you know, if you miss four times, you're out. And if I'm in this group, which I find very helpful, I have to have their therapist instead of my own. And otherwise I can't, you know, all these control features that drive people on. And just the way sessions are managed, you know, people feel pathologized sometimes by DBT therapists, which is the opposite of what Marsha Linehan hoped people would do. So anyway, let me jump to another model, because partly why I make these comments, Kelly, about behavior and about the chains and stuff is that the transference-focused people don't think that way whatsoever. And then Anthony Bateman and mentalization has a, you know, it's a little closer to what DBT does. In the following way, Frank Yeomans did a very interesting interview of this same person. His interview took place as if they were several months into treatment, and so did Anthony Bateman's, and treatment, you know, they're just having therapy at this point, and he's dealing with in the moment, focusing on the transference, and he went through the theory, the model of how people's internal, it's hypothetical that they have that we all have internal roadmaps of relationships made up primarily of these units of a representation of oneself, let's say oneself as a victim, a representation of an object, another person who is a persecutor, for instance. This would be just one of multiple types of paradigms. And they're linked by a certain emotional state, like, you know, feeling afraid or feeling ashamed or something like that, linking affect. And these, you know, the theory with transference-focused therapy is that the person with borderline personality disorder has come to have a way in which there are idealized and very positive self and object experiences sort of registered in the brain and in the mind and in experience, and they're split off from very negative ones, so that there may be the tendency to experience people as really either very positive and dyads and interactions as very positive or very negative, or to cope with the fact that these things are not integrated at all. And of course the ultimate target for somebody who's doing transference-focused therapy is not changing any particular behavior, even though they do follow behavioral outcomes and they do hope to affect change in behavior. That's ultimately the goal. But their real experience near target is integration of these hypothesized internal object relations units, as Kernberg would call them, and Yeomans was teaching. He did a teaching with diagrams and things before he did his interview, and then tried in the interview to demonstrate how these things come alive in the interview, because when you face your therapist, it sets off emotions, and it sets off these, it activates these kinds of internalized units, and then you can sort of see them in front of you, and you can feel them around you in therapy, and then you try to help the person reflect on those rather than to continue to play them out. And so he did an interview with that. You know, that's a very brief thumbnail, simplistic explanation, and anybody with transference-focused therapy would probably critique that up and down if they were listening to this, and I wouldn't blame them. It's too quick for a complex model like that. But that's the basic idea, and he, I think, demonstrated very well that in the back of his mind are these kind of units and this attempt to try to get the person to reflect on these split off, and rather they consider them primitive and harsh units or idealized or devalued units inside, and they get activated in the transference. They try to make sure and get it so that you keep bringing refer it back to the relationship with the therapist so that you can work on it right then and there. It's a here and now treatment for most of the time, and then it gradually starts to loop in more and more of your life, like your close people now and your history of close people in your life, like your family. But really everything keeps getting brought back to what's going on between you and me now, trying to really maintain a position that isn't without compassion. In fact, I thought Yeomans did a nice job of showing some level of flexibility and some level of compassion while trying to maintain a kind of an objective and neutral position from which to help her reflect on things. And it was just so different. I just wish I had a longer time to talk to the patient about what the difference felt like, because I think my interview, it felt like I was basically asking her very strongly to collaborate with me in not killing herself, and that us working together to do everything about that, and not self-harming, and I think there was passion, there was compassion, there was a kind of a directed sense, but it was very different. It was not, let's reflect on the fact of this and the fact of that right then, even though reflection does come into DBT. Very different, a very reflective model. And Anthony Bateman with mentalization-based therapy. I'm guessing a lot of people on the phone know about mentalization-based therapy, maybe some experts on the phone. What was really fun for me is that getting to see him do his interview with the same patient, and then also have he and I both watched Frank Yeoman's interview, and then he and I spent about an hour talking after that just in the hallway about our perceptions of the different models, and what he saw in Yeoman's and how he differentiated that from mentalization-based. And what's interesting that's a little more like DBT is that he is sorting out the chaos. He is sorting out all the data. He's making sense of it by looking specifically for whether the patient is mentalizing and whether the therapist is mentalizing or not. And by mentalizing, really, you know, having that capacity to keep aware of your own mental process and the presumed mental processing and experience and emotions of the other person while you're doing your own, you know, that you're really, there's a reflective capacity that is mentalization, and it's that capacity of sort of being aware of these different things and the complexity of things, as opposed to getting stuck in some sort of circular or flat way of seeing things. One thing he talked about in his interview with this patient was the pretend mode that they talk about in mentalization-based therapy, that he felt that she was in pretend mode a lot, and he was trying to get through encouraging reflection, get her to out of pretend mode and into a mode where she's really mentalizing. So
pretend
the way in which
meaning
it,
what? Say more, would you? What's that mean?
You know, I feel like even in this model, I'm even less conversant than I am. I mean, I've read one book. I've been to one workshop, and I've heard a lot of people talk about mentalization. But I, just because I'm an expert in DBT and a fair amount in transference therapy, I don't want to pretend I'm an expert in this. But my understanding, I mean, and I've is that, you know, this is a complex capacity that human beings have to keep track. While I'm talking to you, I'm aware that there is you, and I'm aware that you're having responses to me, that I'm aware of your mind continues to be present, continues to be processing things while mine is too, so that I need to take that into account. If I'm mentalizing, it means that I'm realizing that you're a human being with a mind, and I'm a human being with a mind, and both are going on, and that it's a life skill, and it's a critical life skill to be able to do that while you're talking to someone else or while you're thinking of someone else. Mm-hmm. And that if all you're thinking about, like this young woman in the interview, she kept thinking that, well, if her boyfriend didn't text her back when she texted him, obviously he doesn't care about her. Obviously he doesn't love her. And God knows what he's doing, even though he said he went to work. And then because he doesn't text her back, she texts him again. And then she'll text him 16 times in an hour to try to get him to respond. And then the more he doesn't respond, the more she's convinced. It's sort of, she gets in a loop that actually doesn't take into account the fact, you know, that there's another human being over there who actually has been pretty devoted to her, and while not perfect, says he loves her and asks her not to do this because it drives him nuts, and he tries to reassure her, and that all goes out the window, and she just has a sort of a flat idea of what's going on, and she keeps responding to it. Now, every model of treatment has to address that and understand that one way or another, but the mentalization model understands that as a failure to mentalize. Mm-hmm. You know, the transference-focused model would see that as the activation of a certain rigid self-object relations unit, and the DBT therapist, I think, would see that as, you know, a certain set of cognitions that are problematic, and emotions that are driven by the cognitions and cognitions driven by the emotions, and it's part of an emotionally dysregulated state with a lot of characteristics to it. But, you know, mentalization is really based on... So one of the things he said is very different is mentalization therapy does not have a hypothesis like that there are any certain object relations units. They're just trying to get somebody to mentalize and feeling like if somebody can mentalize, you know, then they can start to reflect on their life. And so they're trying to increase the frequency and endurance of the capacity to mentalize. And then if you do that, you're going to handle all life situations quite differently. So you do focus a lot on mentalization taking place in the therapy session, but also in the world outside the therapy session. And there's skills that you teach that I haven't learned yet, the component skills of mentalization. So you'll enter a group and you'll get oriented and you'll learn what mentalizing is and you'll learn various things that it's not and you'll learn what you're supposed to do. So it has a kind of like a skills training component to it. And yet it's a very reflective therapy. In that respect, it's like transference focused therapy, but it's not reflective looking for a presumed explanation such as split off object relations units, you know, hypotheses of things like that, or excesses of aggression in the mind or in experience like transference focused therapy also is, sort of has some assumptions about what's probably causing borderline disorder and self-harm and suicide. So It's just so different and so interesting, mm-hmm. and it was such a brilliant idea. People have done it for actually decades. I mean, people did this with psychoanalysis, with people like Albert Ellis and other therapists in the past of having the same person be seen by three different people in a role play and see what they do. So I just thought it was cool because, why? Because I was part of it. Must have been the coolest thing going on, right? Because
like
I was part of it.
Extremely intellectually stimulating.
Oh, it was really fun.
Let me ask you about this last one.
Yes, go ahead.
You guys were standing around in the hall.
Yeah.
You know, what struck you as the most interesting in terms of what he had to say, Bateman had to say?
You know, what was interesting was that he really wanted to make clear to me the differentiation between his model and a transference-focused model. I think because his model does come from a psychodynamic place, a lot of psychoanalytic people are interested in mentalization-based therapy. But I think he was thinking that, you know, these really go in different directions. He thinks he's making less assumptions and less presumptions. So this idea that you're really just, it's almost like, it isn't like teaching mindfulness, Kelly, but I remember when I first read mentalization, I thought, is this another version? Is this like relational mindfulness?
Yeah, exactly.
But then, you know, when I read their book, the first book they came out with, and they specifically talk about things like that. And I realized when I read about it, you know, this is not the same as relational mindfulness. My mind is not back where I made that distinction before. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it suggests, it's that idea. It's like, what if you could just focus the entire treatment on increasing mindfulness and increasing, in particular, relational mindfulness in dyadic and group situations, what a change there'd be in somebody's life if in fact they could just do that much. And so but there's obviously a much more involved model here. He invited me to come to a training and really get steeped in mentalization-based therapy, and they're going to actually, I think he said that he had talked to Linda DeMeff, so you probably know about this, about possibly setting up an online training of mentalization-based therapy through your institute, which I think is, I actually said to him, why don't you do an online training? He said, actually, I just talked to Linda DeMeff about this. I said, Linda DeMeff? Now you're talking in my territory. This is great. So, you know, I said, and Kelly Koerner. Oh, yeah, I know who Kelly Koerner is. So it's, you know, world's shrinking.
It is small. Well, but this, I think, the fascinating, where you were just at with, if you think about what is the mechanism of change, like what actually changes when a person learns to do that or becomes stronger at doing, being able to have this sort of stuff that comes out of the theory of mind, that you can hold the other in your mind and you can accurately see how they are seeing you, like that. If you think back to your very first study you were talking about and what would be activated, both attentionally in terms of the reinforcement system, et cetera, that feels like it might be targeting exactly that. Mm-hmm. Don't you think? Mm-hmm. To me, it would be fascinating to be able to have some of, there was a special series on this about mechanisms of change, but to me, they're really useful and different mechanisms of change that might be related. You know, who knows? It could be that different people really would respond quite differently, because for some it really is one thing, and for another it's really, you know, all the different roads might lead.
You know, and one of the things I find interesting, Kelly, about this too, what you're triggering in saying that is that when you, having practiced two of these models in a fair amount of depth and looked at other models, and you realize that when you are pursuing a certain model, you're doing a lot of things that you might not be thinking about that might be the mechanisms of change. In other words, you may think the mechanism of change is because you're doing X, Y, or Z because that's what your model is and that's what you do and that's what you're focused on. But while you're focusing on that, what you might not be focusing on is a certain relational quality between you and the patient, or a certain way of paying attention, or a certain way of behaving in response to a certain important cue in the session, and that actually isn't even part of your model. And therefore, you really have to open your mind. And what I think is good about seeing these different models, it's like visiting different countries, is that you go to another country and you get a different perspective. You feel like, oh,
yeah,
God, I didn't realize I live with such a narrow frame of reference. I mean, I think what one of the problems of in current work with borderline, when people go to conferences like this, and I'm somewhat a victim of this myself, and I try to fight it, is that there's a tendency to right away choose between the models. Oh, this one must be better. Oh, this one makes more sense. Oh, and then you get into demeaning some models or narrowing in on some models. I mean, even the way I've portrayed these on the phone, I just undoubtedly have all kinds of misunderstandings. But I think what's really important is that there's valuable stuff in every one of these models. I wasn't able to stay for the afternoon. There was another talk coming up, so I got the sort of straight poop about the talk before I left. Ken Levy was going to, he and colleagues have done a meta-analysis of every study of psychotherapy of borderline personality disorder they could find in the literature that have any data, and there are 74 such studies. And they did a meta-analysis of this to see what the effect sizes would be of comparing different models. So I didn't get to be at that talk and what the discussion was about. But, you know, the short answer had to do with, and his stuff will be on the website too, is the short answer had to do with the it did not, at least from what they had, and I don't know how to evaluate that data, I just know this little bit about it, that the effect sizes of no one treatment seem to be that much greater than any other. I didn't know how to put that together with that some treatments like DBT have, you know, 18 published randomized controlled trials, which is way more than any other. So I don't know how you equalize that factor, but I'm not a researcher. I'm not a statistician. So maybe, but it's just interesting. I think the important thing is that there's every model has interesting things going on.
Well,
you know what? I realize it's 9 already.
It is. Hey, Charlie, let me bring you back just one quick comment from me on this the patient's perspective, because you know, there's a whole line of research looking at, you know, the therapist may be intending to have this or that impact or think they're moving this or that process of change, and yet on the receiving end it may land completely differently. You know, so like there's really nice research about exposure and whether comparing straight up exposure response prevention versus a more cognitive versus more acceptance. And the way that the client receives it is also a factor here. So I feel like one of the cool things about this type of research, at least to me, is if there was a way to bring the client's perspective into this more, you know, when you said you wished you could interview her, I wish that was more part of this. Yeah, to have that
group
have more say in the research.
No, it's really, you know, I'd like to follow up on this with you, and maybe we'll even do another call about that and get, you know, some perspectives from that, because I have a lot of thoughts and personal experience having been in about 4 different therapies personally myself, and my own point of view about mechanisms of change in those therapies might be different than the therapist's was.
Yeah, exactly. this is fascinating.
All right.
I'm so glad.
Yeah.
Thanks to Perry and the conference organizers and for you summarizing.
Well, we'll talk about the next thing to do on our next Connecting the Dots, and you and I are doing a training together in a week and a half that's going to be fabulous fun to do that with you, and let's just keep up all the good work.
Good. Good night, everybody.
Really appreciate everybody listening in, whoever's listening, you know, the one or two of you who are out there in New Zealand or something. So, anyway, Kelly and I had fun no matter how many of you there are, and I hope you're all well. Let's end the call.
Okay.
Okay?
Good night.
All right,
Good
Kelly.
Night.
Take care. Good
Bye-bye.
Night.
Bye-bye.